From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is A Good Food Thanksgiving. Today, I've got answers to some of your holiday cooking questions. We'll go to Chinatown for a Chinese-American feast, what the pilgrims actually ate on the first Thanksgiving, wine pairings, and cocktail ideas. Plus, I've got cooking tips from some of LA's best chefs. Happy Thanksgiving, everyone. We have a great show for you today. We're going to start today with some questions from listeners. On Facebook, DK Crawford asked me what to do with a larger size turkey, like more than 22 pounds. Well, I think the most important thing when cooking a really large turkey is to make sure that it is absolutely completely defrosted and brought up to room temperature or very close to it before you throw it in the oven. That bird is going to take a lot of time to cook, and you don't want it to take extra time that you haven't factored in because it's either partially frozen or really, really cold when you put it in the oven. You'll cook it just like any other turkey. It's just going to take a while. Don't forget that basting is a really good friend when cooking a large bird that's going to be in the oven for a long time. Many people have asked how cooking a heritage turkey is different from your traditional butterball. Well, I was at the Santa Monica Farmers Market the other day. I had the opportunity to get help answering some listener questions from chefs who were doing their Thanksgiving shopping. Here's Napa Valley Grill's executive chef, Joseph Gillard.
If I was using a heritage turkey, I would probably actually not brine it. And if I did brine it, I would do a dry brine and simply in salt. I probably wouldn't infuse it with any kind of flavor because I would want the flavor of that. The reason you're spending the money for that heritage breed is the flavor, specifically because it can be a little bit stronger than a regular turkey. But I would definitely roast it a little lower and slower and baste it and augment it with some fat.
Heritage turkeys are really something special. My friend Kazi Patelka has a huge backyard farm at her house in Altadena where she's raising chickens and heritage turkeys. Last week, Good Food producer Harriet Ells visited Kazi and her birds.
So I'm here in Altadena at Kazi Patelka's, really it's a farm back here. And I know Evan's been here many times and I'm so just blown away by this expanse of vegetables and trees and also, as you can hear in the background, chickens and turkeys. Hi, Kazi.
Hello.
How many turkeys do you have?
Right now I only have three. When I did my last turkey order from Porter's Heritage Turkeys, I got about 15. And those numbers have been going down ever since. I gave a few of them away, and last Thanksgiving I ate a couple of them. And then later I decided I didn't want the males anymore. They were just too noisy for me. And now I'm down to three females. I have two royal palms and a sweetgrass.
And which one are you planning on having for Thanksgiving?
Well, if you look in there, there's two royal palms with a slightly bigger one on the left is the one I'm thinking of. And I love having turkeys. I don't think they're stupid at all. I think they're beautiful. I think they have strong personalities. And I think one of the most amazing things that I've felt about raising turkeys is their incredible vocabulary. They have different sounds that they make for different things that they want to express. And the more time you spend around them, the more you recognize, you know, oh, that's their happy sound. Or that's the, oh, she just put out some treats sound. Or in the case of the male have a I'm bigger than you sound. And they also have a I'm really excited sound. And these sounds are really unique. I mean, they run the gamut from sort of expulsions of breath to little chirping sounds, and I find this fascinating.
So you mentioned this idea of the turkey's personality. What is that personality? What traits do you see that turkeys have?
I find them to be very sweet, not at all aggressive, and kind of gentle and mellow. I find them very easy to handle, even though they're quite large, and that's about it.
So we're also talking, you know, really about your dinner, what you're going to be serving on Thanksgiving dinner. Can you talk about what it's like to be caring for this animal that you're ultimately going to kill and eat?
Well, you know, I don't see that as a contradiction at all. A lot of my friends just go, well, how can you do that? Or I could never eat that. I've had people who just absolutely refuse to eat something that I raised and killed. It creeps them out. You know, they want it in styrofoam and cellophane. That's the only way they can feel comfortable. But I feel very differently about it. I feel like this animal has been loved, and I love that animal. I love my animals. I like them a lot, and I like taking care of them. I feel good that I know what kind of life that animal had, rather than just buying something off the rack, especially with everything that we've heard about the way animals are raised in confinement. This animal has been well-loved and had a wonderful life, and to me, I can look at her and say, I love you, and boy, are you going to be delicious.
Do you name the turkeys?
No, although the first year I had turkeys, which was about 3 years ago, I only had three. And I got them from a hardware store up in San Fernando, which is an area where people raise a lot of animals. They had ducks, they had pheasants, they had everything. And they were the standard big hybridized to be a huge broad-breasted bronze turkeys, and they were enormous. The male dressed out at 50 pounds. And that year, which was my first year, I named them, and their names were Thanksgiving, Christmas, and Easter. I wanted to keep it perfectly clear, and they were delicious.
Obviously, these are heritage breeds. They obviously don't look like the huge, you know, tom turkey that we're used to seeing on all the packages and things. Do these birds taste differently, and can you describe that?
Well, there's a couple things I want to say about that. First of all, these turkeys are not bred to have that big, round, plumped-up breast and plumped-up look. You know, when you have one of these turkeys dressed out, this is my experience. I'm not raising them commercially, and I can't tell you what the commercial heritage turkeys look like. But with my turkeys, their breasts look kind of scrawny. They're a little skinnier and bonier. You know, they're not going to come out of the oven and go onto the Thanksgiving table with a tremendous impression because they don't look like a butterball, you know, and they don't look like those broad-breasted bronzes I raised the first year, which were incredibly round and full. That being said, I've really enjoyed, especially with the older birds, making different kinds of dishes with them, braised dishes, and not just roasting it whole and presenting it in that way. But, you know, I just finished reading Peter Kaminsky's book about pork. Pig is called Pig Perfect. And, you know, he talks about porkiness. And I would use the same word, that whatever that turkey flavor is, the turkiness, it's stronger. It's more rich. More like dark meat. The whole thing is more like slightly darker dark meat. And the breast is still white, but it's a little darker than you're accustomed to.
So Thanksgiving's on a Thursday. How many days before it's served will you kill the turkey?
I've been brining my turkeys for a few years, and this year I was just going to do a dry salt rub. But you do want to give the bird a few days for the proteins to relax. So, you know, I could kill it Saturday or Sunday or even Monday, depending on how I was going to treat it. If I wanted to brine it for a while and let it dry overnight, I might kill it on Saturday and let it rest for a couple days and then brine it.
How do you go about killing the turkey?
Well, I've done it a couple ways, and I really think about this a lot. I mean, what's the best for the turkey? And for a long time, I've always killed my birds by just cutting the jugular vein and bleeding them out. That's a kosher way. Some people say that's more humane because they continue to breathe and they just pass out from blood loss. Then I have another friend who raises and kills their own birds, and they firmly believe that you should take a pruner, a lopper, and just take the whole head off right away. Snap, gone. I've tried both ways, and I'm not sure I have a strong opinion about that.
Well, Kazi, thank you for showing us your birds, and I hope you have a great Thanksgiving.
I hope so, too. It's going to be a delicious one, that's for sure.
I've got pictures of Kazi's birds at kcrw.com/ good food. Coming up after this short break, I'll answer more of your questions. Plus, I've got some great recipe ideas. Stay tuned. This is a Good Food Thanksgiving here on KCRW and KCRW.com. For many of us, Thanksgiving continues to be our favorite holiday. Maybe it's the secular nature of the holiday, the fact that we all celebrate together as a nation, and we all bring our own differences to the table. But where did the meal really come from, and what was at that first Thanksgiving table? Kathleen Curtin is a food historian who works for Plymouth Plantation. Her book is Giving Thanks. I'm so glad that you're here this morning.
It's wonderful to be with you. Thank you.
Could you refresh our memories? What was the event that we refer to as the first Thanksgiving, and in what year did it happen?
Sure. In 1621, we know from one letter that exists that William Bradford, who was the colonial governor, sent four men out shooting for geese and ducks, and they brought back as much as would last the company for a week. Somewhere along the way, Massasoit, who was one of the leaders of the Wampanoag, came, brought 90 men, and some deer, and what ensued were 3 days of feasting and diplomacy and celebration, and that has come to be called the first Thanksgiving.
I have to say that I don't think I ever really understood that it was a three-day-long feast of these two groups of people coming together.
There's a lot of mythology that's built up around that event. First of all, it wasn't even a Thanksgiving according to the English Puritans who celebrated it. They would have considered it a harvest celebration. They were two separate events that really weren't connected until historians connected them rather artificially in the 1800s.
Let's talk about what could have been on the table. For sure you knew there were waterfowl, and I imagine that wild turkeys were around. We just don't know if they had any for that particular period of feasting.
That's correct. Yeah, from the description that exists, it makes sense that they are waterfowl, so geese and ducks, the migratory birds. Turkeys were in the area, and both the Wampanoag and the English enjoyed eating them, so there's every likelihood that because it was a three-day event, they may have entered the menu at some point. Venison is a definite, because we know that Massasoit brought that, at least five deer. Pumpkins were commonplace in gardens, both the Wampanoag and the English, and largely root vegetables, things like parsnips and carrots and turnips, onions, leeks, cabbage. Those sort of more hardier fall vegetables would still have been in gardens. We don't think that they probably had the capability to make things like pies. And so while they loved pies, the English loved pies, they didn't have an oven. And I doubt that they had much wheat flour or butter by that time. So meat was definitely the hallmark of the meal.
Was there sugar yet in the colonies?
People probably brought sugar with them. They probably brought spice with them. I've recreated a 1621 harvest feast. I ended up by using a cup of sugar altogether. There's a classic sort of combination in the 17th century of a little vinegar and a little sugar and a brothy sauce that people liked very much. So that certainly would have been within the colony's resources.
What about the pumpkins? What do you think they did with the pumpkin?
Pumpkins, there's recipes in English herbals from the 1600s, and in some of these recipes they take and thinly slice the pumpkin and fry it in butter and put sugar and spice on it, and it's really wonderful. But we also have more dishes typical to what we would assume a pumpkin dish to be.
Now, what about cranberries? If sugar was something that was in scarce supply, one imagines that the early colonists didn't really embrace something that was as tart as a cranberry.
They couldn't certainly make sweet sauces out of it or pies out of it, but they could embrace its natural tartness. In around 1640, they have sufficient supply of sugar that you start seeing references to sweeter dishes, and certainly cranberry sauce, as we would recognize it, boiled cranberries with lots of sugar, was possible by then. They talk about cranberry sauce being a lovely relish for meats, so something you ate alongside meat as we do today.
Do we know what the Wampanoags were doing with the cranberries?
There's a wonderful boiled bread that the Wampanoag make that may have had cranberries in it. They may have also been doing some drying of cranberries, cooking up with them as well, mixing them into some of their pottages and stews. They're such a good source of vitamin C nowadays for us that you have to wonder if the Wampanoag didn't recognize the health principles of them as well.
And of course, we can't possibly think of a Thanksgiving without stuffings. Was stuffing there at that first Thanksgiving?
Bread stuffings were probably not possible, but they would have liked them. They had bread stuffings in England, and they tended to be a little bit more on the sweeter side with dried fruit and some sweet spices in them. Quite wonderful, really. I think if a 17th century English person from 1621 came forward into our Thanksgiving meal, they'd feel pretty comfortable.
Kathleen, bring us forward to when this real version of the first feasting for the harvest time became Thanksgiving.
It's not a date you can pin down. It's more something that evolves. The English Puritans, the colonists who came to Plymouth, celebrated a religious Thanksgiving, which was a day spent in church. And somewhere along the line, you get a meal that sort of attaches to that Thanksgiving. And the first instance I see of that is in 1637 in Scituate. And then it just seems to gain momentum and speed. And by the end of the 1600s, what's happening is ministers and people are starting to call for an annual Thanksgiving that's held in the fall for general blessing. And little by little over time, the meal becomes the most important part of the day. And certainly the celebration of family and friends and reunions are all important parts of that too, right up until modern times.
And when did it actually become a nationally recognized holiday?
Well, there's lots of presidents who call for Thanksgiving throughout the history of early America, but it's Abraham Lincoln who creates the national holiday rather unintentionally. He's been harassed and harangued by the wonderful Sarah Josepha Hale, who wants Thanksgiving to be a national holiday. She's a Yankee, and she really sees that this holiday promotes domestic virtues of hearth and home. So she petitions Abraham Lincoln, and he calls the first day of Thanksgiving that becomes the annualized tradition. He doesn't say that every president afterwards has to call for one, but that's just the trend he starts. It's during FDR's presidency that the holiday becomes part of our laws, and the date of the holiday is chosen as that last Thursday in November, the fourth Thursday in November.
I think the best part of Thanksgiving in 2010 is the incredible variety of flavors present on the table. I'm not just talking about nutmeg and sage. I mean the hodgepodge of ethnic flavors that make up our ever-expanding palate. The other day at the farmer's market, I ran into Sasha Alger, the chef at Street on Highland near Melrose. I asked her what kind of interesting flavors are on her Thanksgiving table.
Well, one of the things we really think about when we're putting together menus is how people eat and how people eat these days, and the family structures have changed so much. The way people celebrate holidays has changed so much. And a lot of times we find ourselves, even if we're in a traditional family, that we're joined by family friends or we're going to somebody else's house or we have three or four Thanksgivings as we do in our household. So we tried to really structure a menu that wasn't based on traditional turkey dinner. Here's the big turkey in the center of the table and the things that go around it, but rather how you would actually go and travel with food to your friend's house, to your family's house, and the kinds of things you would eat in this mixed culture city where food's coming from all over. So a lot of what we do is our cream spinach is actually an Indian dish called Sag Paneer that we're doing with homemade paneer cheese, lots of Indian spices. Still gives that essence of the holidays, but has a lot of more interesting depth and flavor to it. We did a cream corn with coconut and pandan leaf, which is a very Thai-flavored thing, and the pandan plays really well off the sweetness of the corn. And so we just tried to take all those traditional flavors, stuffings, you know, and do stuffings with chorizo and cornbread and celery root purees, but we did it with a provincial French sauce called Grabiche, which is made with hard-boiled eggs and an herb vinaigrette. So just all those flavors that you would usually see and tweak them a little bit, make them a little bit more ethnic, a little more interesting, a little more fitting of our culture today.
Paneer is something that a lot of us see when we go out to Indian restaurants. But to me, it's a really interesting cheese because it's a cheese that has this ability of not melting.
Paneer is almost like a farmer's cheese. It's very fresh. It's a fresh curd cheese, the way you would make mozzarella, for instance. The thing that differentiates paneer is probably that we use yogurt to curd it as opposed to rennet or something which cures cheese usually. But so it's basically milk, yogurt, a squeeze of lemon juice, salt. We actually add chaat masala and other spices to it when we make it, but it's a very simple fresh-made cheese. You can make it in about half an hour. It's very easy to make.
Pandan leaf. Can you try and describe what the flavor of that is? And I just love the idea of taking the corn and creaming it with coconut milk. That just makes so much sense.
Yeah, you know, pandan is another one of those flavors that you can't really describe because it doesn't exist anywhere in our American world, our American palate. I always describe it as this mixture of the ocean, sort of a shrimp, seafood, briny taste with the taste of vanilla bean at the same time. It's kind of sweet, but oceany, and it doesn't come from the ocean, so I don't know why it has that sense to me, but it's just kind of this really interesting, savory, sweet blend of flavors, and there's nothing like it. It's a grass that you steep, and then you actually throw away the grass at the end, so you're just getting the extract from it, but it pairs wonderfully with coconut milk. It's the traditional flavoring in Thai sticky rice, so if anyone's wondering what it tastes like, it's that flavor.
Deep Tran is the owner of Good Girl Dinette in Highland Park. She's from a Vietnamese family, and she told me about her family's unusual holiday side dish.
At our family, the side dish was the turkey. Like, like we knew we had to have a turkey, but my grandma was really flummoxed about what to do with it. And in Vietnamese, the word for turkey is ga tay, ga meaning chicken, and tay meaning Western. So it's like, okay, this Western chicken, what are you supposed to do with it? And it was really always an afterthought. We knew we had to have it. And she didn't really have a lot of love for it. You know, we didn't understand that it had to be ceremoniously brought to the table. Everybody's supposed to ooh and ah. And someone's supposed to have this honor of carving it. And, you know, none of that. Like, it always came already chopped up, like hacked up like a roast duck or something with like the across the bone. And the breast would always like be missing because no one wanted the breast. So she would incorporate like it was like very the opposite of like, you know, I guess like my friend's Thanksgiving where we would vie for the turkey breast. Like in our family, like we didn't get it.
So what did she do with the breast meat?
She would shred it up and she would mix it with steamed sticky rice with shallots. So she usually it's a very traditional Vietnamese dish to have like sticky rice, poached chicken, and shallots. And so she would just substitute the turkey breast with that, and also she would put in Chinese sausage, so it would be kind of larded with that. So it's like the breast would not be dry because it had all this like Chinese pork sausage, you know, fat in it. Or we would make kind of like a turkey cabbage slaw, which, you know, traditionally is made with chicken. So she would find any other way. But I remember my sister and brother and I were like, oh, please, can't it just like be a whole turkey? And can it look like,
see, I'd much rather have your grandma come to my house and she can make me that sticky rice. That sounds pretty delicious.
I do crave it now that she's passed away. But then I was like, oh, can't we just have like some sort of normal, you know, Thanksgiving. I mean, now I make the turkey for my brother and his family, and his mother-in-law is like, do the turkey because I don't want it to deal with it. She doesn't understand it, and it's still, even though it's like whole, it's still the side dish. There's like all this other Vietnamese food at the table, and the turkey is just, yeah. If you're still hungry, here's the turkey. When I make the turkey now, we actually infuse it with some Vietnamese. Like we do, it's like a cross between Judy Rogers dry brine and then like a wet brine where instead of salt, I put fish sauce and hoisin and cloves, cinnamon and sesame oil. And I just kind of make it like a paste and marinate it for 3 days so it kind of dries out. And then I incorporate a southern technique where you butter a paper bag. And then and it's like, it tastes great. It tastes like a Vietnamese turkey. And, you know, so that's what we do now. We don't really do a traditional, you know, turkey.
So, you know, I've never actually myself done the buttered paper bag technique.
It's great.
So literally you take like a grocery store paper bag.
Yes. And you butter all the inside, like a lot. Like, but it makes like great. It makes a great base for like your gravy. It's pretty freaking awesome. And you don't have to baste it. And it's golden and it's crispy. And it's like kind of magic. I started that. It was in a Savour magazine article I read when I was in I think it was in college or right after college, and I said I'd give it a try, and we've done it every time.
At what temperature do you cook the bird?
I think it's like 375. Yeah, it's not any different than what I usually do. Yeah, and then there you go. And then sometimes if it doesn't brown, which it always does, but if something's wrong with the oven, I crank it up just to crisp it out. But yeah, I remember just standing in front of the oven for a long time, like, it's going to go on fire.
Now, do the juices seep through the bag?
It does. Like, I use a rack so it doesn't, so the bottom is crispy as well as the top. And it makes a really great gravy. You don't have to, the butter's already in there for you.
Thank you so much, Deep.
Thank you so much, Evan.
Deep's recipe for Vietnamese turkey is at kcrw.com/goodfood. I've got details on how to roast the turkey in a paper bag there, too.
My name is Charles Song. My family immigrated to the United States from South Korea in 1970. My parents thought Thanksgiving was essentially the Korean harvest festival, which we call Chuseok. And although Chuseok in Korea usually falls about a month earlier before Thanksgiving in the United States, they thought it was basically the same thing that they celebrated a month later. So it actually fit in really well with, you know, our culture and with our traditions, etc., because it was a time for Koreans to celebrate the harvest and for all the families to get together and have a giant feast, which, you know, essentially is what, you know, they thought Thanksgiving was. It was very easy for them to adjust to, or at least so they thought, because they just treated Thanksgiving as a typical Korean harvest festival. And I think initially our first few Thanksgivings, we only had Korean food. It was just, you know, exactly the same as we would celebrate in Korea.
My name is Chung Bui. I'm 31 years old, and I live in Silver Lake in Los Angeles. I grew up in a Vietnamese family, and my fiancé is Japanese-American, so I think it was initially surprising for her to see how everyone kind of, whenever we would see each other, when we'd step into the house, everyone would start hugging each other and kissing each other and, like, calling each other honey and baby and stuff. And she said it's a little different from the way she grew up. It's interesting going from house to house, and every aunt or uncle would have prepared something different, you know, to snack on. And then eventually you would make your way to where Thanksgiving was being held, like, throughout the week. The climax would be, you know, that big Thanksgiving dinner at someone else's house. But during the week, you would have different varieties of noodle soups that would be, like, ready for you whenever you'd arrive. U tiu, which is, like, egg noodle soup, or bún thang, which is, like, Vietnamese rice vermicelli noodle soup with eggs, Chinese sausage, Vietnamese sausage. Bún riu, which is Vietnamese crab noodle soup. Pho, of course.
Hello, I'm Erica Tumbaga. I'm a 32-year-old Filipino-American. My uncle is from Guanajuato, Mexico. My mother's side of the family is from Banaue, Ifugao in the Philippines. My sister had married a Vietnamese man. And so we all kind of have been combining all of these foods. Especially during Thanksgiving, things kind of change up a little bit because you get introduced to the tamales and the Vietnamese type of, you know, lechon. For Thanksgiving, we make a lot of Ilocano dishes that are also familiar in most parts of the Philippines. Pancit, which is a noodle dish. The particular pancit my aunt makes is clear noodles. When they want to get, you know, extra wild on Thanksgiving, they'll make dinuguan, which growing up they called that chocolate stew, and it's not chocolate stew. It's this fantastic, rich pig blood stew that's really, you know, strong with vinegar and tripe, and it's fantastic. I mean, until you know what it is growing up, you stop eating it. Most Filipinos will stop eating it, and then they get back when they can appreciate it as they're adults.
I'm Frank Molina. I was born in East Los Angeles, and I now live east of East Los Angeles in the San Gabriel Valley. Our family Thanksgiving dinner is actually a medley. I call it kind of organized chaos in the kitchen. Turkey is not something Mexicans really eat, at least not where my mom is from the state of Chihuahua, or where my father is from the state of Guanajuato. my mother, who arrived here in 1968, one of her first jobs was working as an aide to a family, an American family. And they taught her how to prepare and how to bake turkey. We have the traditional mashed potato and gravy, but we also have things such as chicharrones guisados con chile, which are pork rind skins that are slow braised on a cooktop with green chiles. I'll also ask my mother to prepare a variety of salsas to just kind of drizzle over the various side dishes.
My name is Nadine Rajabi. I'm a resident of Santa Monica, California. I grew up in Orange County in a Persian, or some people will call it Iranian, family. Persian Thanksgivings are so special because, you know, it's like they try to adapt to the American culture where they have a turkey and they try to maybe do, I don't know, gravy. But then, like, you show up and there's some weird, like, things. Like, you don't have traditional stuffing. We have this thing called albalu polo, which is basically cherry rice. And, you know, typical families, you open up the turkey, you have, like, awesome stuffing. Like, you know, it's homemade from scratch. People have been slaving over it for days. My mom puts cherry rice inside a turkey and thinks that's okay. And you know what? In my growing up, I actually did think it was totally normal until I went to another Thanksgiving and I was like, where's the cherry rice?
Hi, this is Eddie Lin with Good Food. I'm in Los Angeles' Chinatown at Hapu Barbecue on Broadway, and I'm here to experience the Chinese barbecue turkey. When I was growing up, my mother would cook a Thanksgiving turkey, and everything else, all the sides were Chinese. So we would have Chinese noodles, Chinese vegetables, and everything else just accompanied this turkey, which really didn't go together. But as the years went on, we would find one year mashed potatoes and gravy would pop up with the turkey. The year after that, my mother would discover stuffing, and we would have stuffing with the turkey. And so this would go on until our Thanksgiving dinner actually, resembled an actual American Thanksgiving dinner. Now, one of the things I love about living in L.A. is discovering the twists and the influences of a particular culture on a very American holiday like Thanksgiving. So today we're going to discover the Chinese barbecue turkey at Hapu.
All right, ready?
Oh, my goodness. We've just been presented this gorgeous brown turkey stuffed with rice by Chef Lupe Liang of Hop Wu. And
yeah,
so this is what you serve for Thanksgiving.
Yeah, okay.
Oh, this is beautiful. I've never seen a Chinese Thanksgiving turkey before. This is my first time. So how was this? How did you make this? The way he came up with this American Chinese Thanksgiving turkey is when he was a chef in Mexico for many years. He actually came up with this idea for an American turkey, but he used a Mexican and Chinese technique because he felt when he made a turkey Mexican style, it would be too salty, but when he made it Chinese style, it would be too dry. So he kind of combined a little bit of each technique and perfected this American turkey with Chinese and Mexican techniques, which is fantastic. And it kind of makes perfect sense because this is such a great melting pot holiday. So to begin the process of cooking the Chinese turkey, Chef Lupe will rub the bird with salt, sugar, and star anise, and basically it'll brine for 4 hours. Along with all that, the seasoning rub, there's a special sauce that he makes with seafood sauce, garlic, and a bunch of other sauces that are too many to name. That's his special creation. And that's also rubbed all over the turkey.
And
the next step is, after it's been brining for 4 hours, Chef Lupe will put it into boiling water really quickly, just to cook it really, really quickly, just barely, and remove it. And then another sauce will go on, which is a red vinegar and honey sauce. And that'll be rubbed, that'll be applied all over the turkey. And as soon as that's done, it'll be fan-dried for 3 hours.
So, 风干了就什么?
风干以后,完后就,我们就拿这个东西来...
And as soon as it's fan-dried, it'll be placed into the roaster. It'll be hooked by its tail with the head facing down, so all the juices stay inside the body to keep it moist. So the turkey neck is actually turned into a soup, and the other off parts, like the giblets and the liver, is they're roasted along with the turkey. As soon as they're cooked, they're chopped into little fine bits and turned into a dipping sauce for the turkey. Chef Lupe just said that most of the side dishes have turkey incorporated into the dishes. The interesting thing about all this is where in American tradition, you get a week of leftovers to be turned into like some kind of casserole or turkey, you know, soup. In this Chinese Thanksgiving meal, all that extra turkey is actually part of the actual Thanksgiving meal on that very day. That holds true for most Chinese meals where there's mostly, you know, this one theme where it's fish or something like that, and everything has that with all the other dishes. And the food just keeps coming, just like you would expect for a Thanksgiving dinner. Now we just got a mushu turkey wrap. We have a fried lemon turkey with the lemon sauce dip. And we have turkey curry. Everything is made from turkey. And there's so many tastes, so many flavors. This is wonderful. This is exactly what I hoped for coming to Chinatown, you know, trying to discover the Chinese way of celebrating Thanksgiving. And I found it here at Hop Wu with thanks to Chef Lupe Liang. 谢谢,真的。 This is Eddie Lin wishing you a very happy Thanksgiving.
Hop Wu is serving their Thanksgiving feast all day. So if you're still looking for a place to go, head on over to Broadway and College in Chinatown. Coming up in 1 minute, more of your Thanksgiving questions answered. I've got tips for vegans and gluten-free folks, plus how an NFL player celebrates when he's playing on Thanksgiving Day. Stay tuned. This is a Good Food Thanksgiving. I'm Evan Kleinman, and this is A Good Food Thanksgiving on 89.9 KCRW and KCRW.com. I realize that turkey isn't for everyone. Vegetarians and vegans enjoy this harvest festival, too, and so do gluten-free folks. Gluten-free gravy is actually really easy to make. What you want to do is avoid the flour used to thicken the gravy, so you'd still use your same flavorful broth, whether it's vegetarian or meat-based. And to thicken it, I use cornstarch, but Akasha Richmond of Akasha in Culver City told me that she uses rice flour. Akash is famous for her vegetarian and vegan options that she serves at her restaurant on Thanksgiving Day. I caught up with her while she was shopping at the farmer's market, and I asked her to share some secrets to making vegan-friendly dishes.
What I usually do tofu, I marinate it, I roast it, and this year I'm doing it with different kinds of wild mushrooms, like chanterelles and hen in the woods, because it's the texture that vegetarians usually miss. And the, you know, then we do the sage and shallots and garlic and thyme, and then a separate vegetarian gravy, which is great, you know, usually with a little mushroom stock. So they really get a lot of flavor. And then it's easy to do everything else vegetarian.
So many people think that copious amounts of melted butter and cream are such an important part of the mashed potato experience. How do you go about making a really delicious vegan mashed potato?
Well, there's two ways. If you like soy, you can, you know, mash them with hot soy milk. Obviously not the sweetened one, you know, like a plain one. You know, olive oil's great, but there's also, I think it's Earth Balance makes a great vegan spread that's made with olive and canola oil that doesn't have a weird flavor, and you fold some of that in. Or just smashing them with olive oil is delicious. A great way to make good stuffing without using butter, use a great olive oil. I think that's fine. I love olive oil. Maybe not a strong flavored olive oil, but you could try one of the spreads that you get at the natural food store that's dairy-free. They're not bad. You have to taste them, see which one you like. There are some great dairy-free recipes for pumpkin pie. The easiest thing to do is take your favorite pumpkin pie recipe and substitute a non-dairy milk, maybe a little less. If the recipe calls for a cup of cream or regular milk, use 3/4 cup of soy milk. I recommend soy or almond milk. Rice milk is a little watery. You can also use silken tofu, but that's only if you're doing a vegan pie. If you need an eggless pie, you've got to use the silken tofu because it'll keep the pie, it'll hold its shape. But if you just need to not use dairy, soy milk or almond milk is perfect.
I've got a recipe for vegan pumpkin pie on our blog. It's at kcrw.com/goodfood. Since we're talking about alternatives, maybe we should think about how the turkey feels. I mean, I'm sure they're not too happy about being the centerpiece of our meal. One option is to adopt a turkey instead of eating one. Tricia Ritterbush of Farm Sanctuary has more on their Adopt a Turkey program.
We are the nation's largest farm animal protection organization, and we've been around since 1986. And we work to expose and stop cruel practices of the food animal industry through research and investigations, legal and institutional reforms, public awareness projects like our Adopt a Turkey project, as well as youth education and direct rescue and refuge efforts. And we have sanctuaries in Watkins Glen, New York, and Orland, California. Our Adopt a Turkey project features 8 of our rescued turkeys, 4 at our New York shelter and 4 at our California shelter. Every year we usually focus on just 8 turkeys. We actually have over 90 turkeys that live at our sanctuaries. But we try to feature turkeys that have come from different rescues and spread the wealth out between the two sanctuaries. And the $20 adoption, gift adoption, goes towards the care and feeding of all of the turkeys that live at our sanctuaries.
So it isn't the case where we get to adopt a turkey and bring it home with us?
Well, that's not necessarily true, because you can also do that. Home adoptions are another component of our Adopt a Turkey project. And home adopters, there are some criteria initially. They must be vegetarian or vegan and committed to providing lifelong care for their turkey friends. And we have about 6 different Turkey Express drop-offs scheduled for prior to Thanksgiving. And these will go to loving families and other sanctuaries that want to take care of turkeys.
Do you keep track of the turkeys you adopt out to make sure they haven't, you know, been felled by the Thanksgiving knife?
We do. Yes, we have a pretty arduous adoption application and process. It requires veterinary recommendations. We need to know what kind of environment you would be providing for the turkeys. We want to make sure that the kind of life that these turkeys are given would be of the same quality of life that we can offer them at our sanctuaries.
Tell us a little bit about how your turkeys are treated. I understand that each year you actually do a feast for the turkeys.
Yes, we do. In fact, those feasts are coming up this weekend. On Saturday, we'll be inviting 250 people to our California shelter, where we will have a fully catered meal for them. It's a vegan feast for the people. And then everyone will walk up to the turkey barn, and we have a feeding of the turkeys ceremony, where we feed them cranberries and lettuce and squash and pumpkin pie. So people can get to meet these turkeys face-to-face and see how what wonderful social creatures they are.
More about Farm Sanctuary's Adopt a Turkey program is at kcrw.com/goodfood. For a lot of people, football is part of their Thanksgiving tradition. Maybe they're throwing the ball around the yard or they're watching a game on TV. Sports fan or not, Thanksgiving and football are inextricably linked. Good Food producer Harriet Ells talked to a guy who'll be suiting up on Turkey Day.
Nick Harris is a punter for the Detroit Lions, a team that's played on Thanksgiving Day for the last 70 years. In fact, this is the 71st year of Lion football on Thanksgiving. So, Nick, how does it feel to be a part of such history?
It's a blast. We're the only show in town, and we're the only game on right then. And we know everybody's watching, and it's the big show, and so it's pretty exciting. And hopefully we can win.
Can you talk about how it works? I mean, when do you celebrate Thanksgiving?
Right after. I've been here for 8 years now, and there's been years where we've gone to a restaurant. Usually we've gone to Benihana and done, you know, they're open on Thanksgiving, and, you know, the chef flips all the stuff around. And then there's been years where, you know, we put a turkey in the oven and had all the stuff ready and did that ourselves. And the team chef can provide turkeys and all the fixings here with the team as well. So there's a lot of ways to get taken care of, and we've tried them all.
So your game day meal then is different from a normal game day on Thanksgiving Day?
Well, after the game, but you know, before the game, yeah, it's the same as it always is. We'll have we have a pretty nice spread, which could pass for Thanksgiving almost anywhere else in the world. You know, we come out, I mean, there's always eggs and bacon and all kinds of pancakes, waffles. There's, you know, they usually have fillets for, you know, guys that like to have a steak, even for breakfast, you know, all kinds of potatoes. They'll have an omelet bar. I mean, you name it. So that whole spread can pass for Thanksgiving any day of the week.
Wow.
So, that's what we do. But then after the game's over, we'll have our regular Thanksgiving dinner. Usually guys will have that with their own families and people who are in town.
So that's good. So you don't have to like celebrate on Friday or anything.
No. Usually, you know, our game starts at 12:30, so we're done by 3:30, 4 o'clock. Home by 5:30, and so usually, you know, if you want to put it all together, you can get it done.
Can you talk a little bit about your family's Thanksgiving tradition? Like, is there any dishes that your wife makes that you love, or your mom, or?
Yeah, well, I grew up in Phoenix, Arizona, and my mom's family is Italian. And so what we used to do is we'd have stuffed shells, you know, with the ricotta cheese,
yeah,
or ricotta, you know, and have like an Italian a meal. And sometimes we'd mix that with like a fettuccine and, you know, chicken parmesan or something like that. And then growing up in Arizona, you know, we're always outside and made it a outdoor meal.
Playing on Thanksgiving Day has really become like your family's tradition. You have young children, right?
Right, I have 4 kids, and we've been here for 8 years now, and it really has become a tradition, you know, for everybody to, you know, we'll fly people into town. This year, my family's coming to town, and so then we'll go to the game, and the Lions are going to win, and then, you know, I think this year we're going to make our own. turkey, and somebody's going to stay home and put all of it together for everybody else when the game's over.
So does your wife do the turkey? Who does the turkey?
Well, this year I think Mama wants to go to the game, so I think maybe Grandma's going to stay home and do all that.
Nick Harris is a punter for the Detroit Lions. They play the New England Patriots today. I'll be back with more Thanksgiving stories and recipe ideas after this short break. For the last couple of months, we've been featuring a weekly bonus good food podcast called Side Dish. I've interviewed some amazing chefs and cookbook authors about their favorite side dish recipes, and I had a chance to chat with Dori Greenspan, the incredible cookbook author and baker. Her latest book is Around My French Table. I asked her what she likes in a side dish.
I like green beans. I love broccoli. I love spinach. You know, it depends. It really, of course, it depends on the main course. And I also like things that are a little sweet and savory. Again, depending on what the main is.
So give me an idea. If you had to pull one recipe from Around My French Table to offer as a side dish, what would it be?
Well, I'm going to give you something completely different from what I said.
Okay.
I have this dish that has, you know, I always love dishes that have a story. This has a story. I've called it pumpkin stuffed with everything good.
Mm.
And the recipe was given to me. I have a good friend in Paris, Hélène Samuel, and it was her sister who gave her the recipe. And it's her husband who grows pumpkins outside of Lyon. And her little kids go to the field and they carve their names in the pumpkin just as they start to grow. And so as the pumpkin grows, their names grow with it. And they make the stuffed pumpkin dish when the pumpkins are harvested. And so each child has his or her own pumpkin, private pumpkin. And I love this dish. I love the story behind it. And I love that it's a very versatile dish. So you take a small pumpkin and you take the top off and scoop it out and then salt and pepper it. And then you start filling it. And you can fill it with just about anything. It's really, it's more an arts and crafts project than a recipe. The standard for me is dried breadcrumbs and onion and garlic and bacon and herbs, though you could certainly do this as a vegetarian dish, and then some heavy cream. It gets put in the oven, and it bakes until the filling is all soft and bubbly and the pumpkin turns a really burnished, beautiful color. And then it's ready to be served. And it can be served in two ways. You can either slice the pumpkin and give everyone what I think of as a smile of pumpkin with the stuffing, or you can reach in with a big spoon and stir everything around and grab the pumpkin meat from the side of the shell and mix it all together so that it's really just soft and creamy. I love this dish.
As you feel the pumpkin, are you filling it very nearly all the way up?
Yes, filling it nearly all the way up. And then you have to judge just how much cream to put in. Actually, I usually put cheese in as well. But you could make this I did it once with leftover rice. It was delicious, almost like a risotto. You could add spinach and chard. You could make it a little sweet with dried cranberries or pieces of apple. It would be fabulous with chestnuts in it. It's really more an idea than a recipe. And actually, yesterday, my friend Hélène called me from Paris, and she said that she found out something new about the recipe that she didn't know. And that was that the person who originally gave the family the recipe had gotten it when she was mountain climbing in the Alps, and she had stopped at a retreat. And this was the only dish that was served at the retreat. And it was served primarily because it was, well, aside from the fact that it's delicious, that it could be served without many serving dishes or platters. It was really a very rustic retreat. And this was the dish that was served.
So interesting. And what I love about it is, first of all, people are just delighted when they see this whole pumpkin come to the table.
It's beautiful.
It's beautiful. And it's like a little present because you get to open it up and look inside.
No, you're absolutely right. There's absolutely nothing about this recipe that I don't find charming. From the way it looks to the way you can play with the innards, to how it's served. And it is, you're right, it's like a little present. It's a delight to see it at the table. And you can make it, I usually make it in like about a two and a half or three pound pumpkin, which serves about four. But you could make it tiny and everybody could have their own little pumpkin. You could make it bigger. It's really something to play around with. And I love that aspect of it.
Thank you so much, Dori.
Thanks, Evan.
Dori's recipe for pumpkin stuffed with everything good is at kcrw.com/goodfood. Thanksgiving isn't just an American holiday. Believe it or not, Canadians have one too. Lindsay William Ross is the editor of LAist, and she's also from north of the border. I caught up with Lindsay last week at the farmer's market and asked her exactly when Canadian Thanksgiving is.
So Canadian Thanksgiving is the second Monday in October, and that typically winds up being the same as our Columbus Day.
It kind of makes sense, I guess, because it gets colder up there, so maybe you want to have the harvest festival when you're harvesting things before there's snow everywhere, right?
Exactly, and that's really the sole origin of the holiday, is a harvest and to celebrate what you've brought in and the bounty and to give thanks for that.
Is it as embedded in the culture as it is here?
Not at all. I called my mother and I called my grandmother just to kind of talk about our family and being Canadian and traditions and what it means as a Canadian to celebrate Thanksgiving. And I'm going to embarrass my homeland here, but it's not really a big deal. In fact, my grandmother, although she's 80, she kept saying it's a day off school. You know, there's no parades, there's no football, there's no national tradition. I do hear, though, that since Americans are so patriotic, and since maybe the Olympics in Vancouver, and there's this sort of, it's okay to show your Canadian pride, there is a little bit more, like, Canadian patriotism. But we're so polite that it's just a very quiet, reserved, thankful day.
So is turkey part of the table just like it is here?
Yeah, turkey's the central thing. Cranberries, mashed potatoes, pumpkin pie. I do understand that yams don't play such a big part in our cornucopia, but the one thing that we must have, according to my family and that I remember, is Brussels sprouts.
Do you have people dressed up as Puritans?
No.
Well, you know, you gotta ask.
Right, yeah, it's funny. You know, there's no pilgrim story to go with it. It's just this sort of timid kind of thing about family and spirit and gratitude, but even that's really gentle and subtle. So yeah, there's no costuming, there's no historical reverence or anything like that.
Thank you so much, Lindsay.
You're welcome.
You're listening to A Good Food Thanksgiving here on KCRW and KCRW.com. Stay tuned for the second hour of our show after this short break. I'm Evan Kleinman, and this is KCRW and KCRW.com. Welcome back to A Good Food Thanksgiving. I'm your host, Evan Kleinman. Coming up this hour, I'll answer more of your questions and we'll talk wine pairings and leftovers. First, one of the most common questions that I've heard from listeners is about stuffing, also called dressing, in or out of the bird. I asked Evan Funke, the chef at Rustin Canyon Wine Bar in Santa Monica, what he thought.
Absolutely out. A lot of people are turned off by the mushiness of stuffing that's inside the turkey, so I like to do outside so it gets nice and crispy.
I have to say that I agree with Evan. Why take the risk of making a festive holiday into a trip to the emergency room for salmonella-infected stuffing? Instead, you can get really moist, flavorful side dressing by just using a lot of sautéed onions, more than you think you need, and a really flavorful homemade turkey or chicken broth. I typically make a chestnut stuffing at my house, but when I talked to Evan Funke at the Santa Monica Farmers Market, he gave me a really interesting idea for dressing using chanterelle mushrooms.
I love chestnuts, first of all, and what goes awesome with chestnuts is field chanterelles in a stuffing, maybe some figs, some brioche, cavolo nero, fantastic.
Ooh, I've never thought of putting greens in. And I like the idea of brioche. I usually actually get challah. I order super extra rich challah from one of the bakeries on Fairfax. So it's like brioche.
Fantastic.
It's like
yeah.
brioche.
Challah is fantastic. I like to use croissant sometimes as well.
Wow, that's super rich. That wouldn't be buttery enough. Maybe you wouldn't have to melt so much butter and dump into the stuffing.
No, you
then. So when you do it, do you just take all your different, your aromatics and the different fungi and vegetables and sauté them all together? Do you prepare things separately and then mix them in with the bread?
Totally separate, because I find the mushy aspect to the stuffing can kind of put people off to it. So I like to do everything separately, then put it together, and then gratin it in the oven.
That's really a good idea. Yeah, you know what I've started doing, actually, is after I make my mixture, I sort of do the equivalent of double sautéing it, where I press it down into a really thin, like, jelly roll pan or sheet pan and put it in so there's tons of crust. Because I notice over the years that people go for the crust first.
Yeah, it's like good macaroni.
Exactly.
It's all about the crust.
It wouldn't be Thanksgiving in my house without chestnuts. Usually friends gather the night before for drinks, conversation, and the ritual peeling of the chestnuts. First, you want to start off with beautiful chestnuts, which right now you can find at the farmers markets and Whole Food markets. Preheat the oven to 425 degrees, clean all dirt off the chestnuts, then use the sharp paring knife to cut an X into one side of each chestnut. This allows the steam to escape and prevents giant explosions in your oven. Arrange chestnuts on a baking sheet or in a shallow pan with the cut or pricked side up. Roast in the oven for 15 to 25 minutes or until the chestnuts are tender and that little X you've made has opened up a bit. Peel the nuts when they're cool enough to handle. I like to wrap them up in a slightly moist towel. You might have to scrape off some of the papery brown peel with a paring knife. Try not to eat them all. Stacy Hunt is a sommelier who comes to us from Duvan Wine and Spirits and Splash Productions. She frequently joins us on Good Food to share wine pairing ideas. While we were at the Santa Monica Farmers Market last week, Stacy and I talked about why wine pairing for the Thanksgiving meal can actually be pretty tough.
Well, what happens is, on any big holiday or any big occasion, that's when you say, let's go break out the big good bottle. And usually the big good bottle that you have is a big California Cabernet or perhaps a Bordeaux or something that's, you know, got some robustness to it. And that's really not going to work for Thanksgiving as well as some of the wines that we're going to play around with today. And the reason is these big wines have a lot of tannin. So tannin is that stuff that when you drink wine, it kind of feels like you have little socks on your teeth, you know, and you can kind of feel that in your mouth. That is what makes a red, big, robust wine wonderful. Also gives a lot of lasting quality, which is why they age so well. But when you're thinking of Thanksgiving, what are the foods you're eating? They're big, they're robust, they're savory, they're sweet, they're salty, they're sour, they're all the combinations on that day. So you want a wine that's not going to have an argument with that food, but rather a wine that will flow along and dance in the same two-step. So you'll have a wine with some sweetness or a wine, you know, with maybe some savory aspect to it, some herbaceousness, staying away from some of the big, big wines and going more towards the lighter and flavorful wines.
So interesting. So set us up. What are we going to pour in our glass?
Coming to us from France and coming all over the world from France, from the area of Beaujolais, is the great fun wine Beaujolais Nouveau. And it has just hit all over the world just a few days ago. And this wine is hand-picked. It's the only wine outside of the grapes and champagne that has to be picked by hand by law.
And it is fresh. It's made with what's called carbonic maceration, where it just bubbles around for a little while on its own skins, and then it's drained off very young and youthful. And this wine can run the gamut of having a slight pomegranate tang, cranberry tang to it, all the way to having a tropical fruit tang to it. And it's a beautiful light ruby red.
What about Rieslings?
My second favorite wine, if I were not going to have something red, and by the way, I would chill that Beaujolais Nouveau, I would go to a Riesling either from Germany, from Austria, or from its mother lode, where I think it's the very best, Alsace, or even from Italy. And I would take this Riesling and I would pair it with any white meat that I'm going to have that day, be it turkey, be it a pork roast. Has a little spice, has a lot of honeysuckle to it, but the trick of a Riesling is when you put it into your mouth, your tongue immediately tastes the sweet, and you go, oh, this is sweet. Then all of a sudden, as it flows across your mouth, you go, oh my gosh, it's kind of lemony, kind of citrusy. And then as you swallow it, it is just so clean and fresh. So it's another one that will cut through the yams with the with the marshmallows on it, or the, you know, the heavy, you know, gravy that you prepare.
So do you have some names for us?
I think maybe the most famous name and the most price-friendly name is Trimbach. And Trimbach comes from Alsace. And I would look for that one because it's available just about everywhere you go. And they make several different versions of it, so you can find pricing anywhere from about $12 to about $25.
Are there any names we should know about for Beaujolais other than the most famous, Georges Deboeuf?
The other one that has really gained fame is Louis Tet. T-E-T-E. And Louis Tet is one of the guys that says that his is closer to the Beaujolais, the Cru Beaujolais. But because he shipped his wine over this year on a boat instead of by air, which actually they all did to save some money, Louis Tet's wines, who used to be a little more expensive, are now wandering around the streets for about $9 or $10 a bottle.
What if we want a red wine? We just want to have a nice red wine on the table.
There are two that I would recommend for this holiday. The first one is a Pinot Noir, either from California or from Burgundy, because this is a wine that's, again, low in tannin, sort of medium-bodied. It's light enough to not argue, but really just have a good conversation with your turkey and all of your trimmings. Another one that I think is even more interesting and maybe more surprising for your family and your guests would come from Italy, an area below Rome on the Adriatic side, and it's the Abruzzo area, and there is a grape there called Montepulciano d'Abruzzo. And this wine is very soft, but doesn't mean it's flabby or characterless. And it just goes with everything. And I mean, it's the wine you should have in your cabinet at all times. Because no matter who comes over, no matter what you decide to prepare, this wine will go with it. And it's around town right now in magnums, and you can find it for right around $20 in magnum.
And how festive that would be to have a really big bottle at the table. You know what I love about all these suggestions you've given us is it embraces the whole idea of Thanksgiving, that it should be inclusive. And sometimes you have everybody contributing all this food, and then you get to the wine, and it can be a little intimidating to people. And this is one holiday where you don't really want to be the effete wine person at your table.
This is the one holiday, I think, where I would finally say, don't wear your good shoes and don't drink your good wine. You know, wear your comfortable shoes and pull out a beautiful, comfortable bottle of wine and just enjoy it with your family and friends.
Stacy's wine suggestions are on our blog at kcrw.com/goodfood. I'll be back after this short break with more Thanksgiving stories and recipes. You're listening to A Good Food Thanksgiving.
Aida Mollenkamp seems to be everywhere these days on food TV. Of course, there's her wonderful question and answer show, Ask Aida, which is on Food Network. And there's the new Food Crafters on the Cooking Channel. We've asked her to come by today to talk about one of her favorite side dishes. So I understand that you have something that's a bit of a twist for us.
Yeah, I think so. I have grown up in a family that's a little bit of everything, vegetarians, pescatarians. And so for me, when it comes to side dishes for the holidays, I like to turn to something that it can kind of be a main for vegetarians as well. So I made a vegetarian shepherd's pie.
Tell us what the ingredients are in a more traditional one and then what you do.
Well, you know, the main thing with a traditional one would be that there's lamb in there and the potatoes on top, and then it goes under kind of the stew with the potato covering, gets all broily and crisp on top. I still wanted that crispness and that stew quality, but, you know, I obviously wanted to get rid of the meat. And so I turned to mushrooms because they have that umami and just that punch of flavor, and then put in a lot of other seasonal vegetables like carrots and potatoes and parsnips and all those fabulous root vegetables that kind of make the fall worthwhile.
And do you have a secret way you love making mashed potatoes for the potato topping?
Oh, geez. I'm from a meat and potatoes family that, you know, is based in Ohio. So it is constant battle. But for this one, I find that just standard russets with unsalted butter, you know, boiling them and mashing them together, that's a great topping because there's so much flavor in the stew. You want the potatoes to be an addition. You don't want them to overwhelm it with some kind of crazy, I don't know, goat cheese mashed potato. Although something like a roasted garlic would add, you know, another level of flavor if you're so inclined.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize winning restaurant critic for the LA Weekly, is here with us today to talk about his alternative take on Thanksgiving. Do you really do two Thanksgivings every year?
I do two Thanksgivings every year.
And what is the alternative one?
I do a Thanksgiving the Sunday before. I call it a pre-Thanksgiving.
And are the same people invited to both, or does the pre-Thanksgiving have a completely different guest list?
It has a completely different guest list.
And what parameters do you use for those invitees?
They're basically my friends, people who come over to my house for dinner all the time.
They're the people that you want to see.
Exactly. Not that I don't want to see my family. I love my family. But my family has a very preconceived notion of what a Thanksgiving should be. Plus, I must say, the last 7 or 8 years, I've had to go to my cousin's house in Walnut Creek, who keeps me out of the kitchen at knife point.
So do you use this pre-Thanksgiving as an opportunity to experiment?
It started a long time ago when I was at the LA Times food section, and my wife was the editor. As you know, when you work for publications, there's a different turkey every year. And we'd use it as sort of a occasion to try out whatever the hot new turkey was that year. So we've done like the Chinese steamed turkeys, and we've done the Middle Eastern turkeys, and we've done Cuban turkeys. And
tell me about the turkey that had you elbow deep.
For a long time, the Los Angeles Times ran what we called the ultimate turkey or the Times turkey, which was a actually delicious but unlovely concoction that involved stuffing the bird under the skin instead of in the cavity.
I think that is such a brilliant idea. Lumpy looking, but brilliant.
It is really bad. It looks like somebody's pillow stuffed with pine cones.
And did your mother take to that one?
My mother did not take to that one. The big advantage of that turkey is that you can cook it very quickly. I mean, it cooks in an hour and a half.
So let's go back to your experimental Thanksgiving. Do you ever bring anything back? Or is it part of your sort of gestalt that you must have everything new each pre-Thanksgiving?
Actually, my pre-Thanksgivings have gotten to be almost as rote as my regular Thanksgivings at this point. I mean, I always do the apple sausage and chestnut stuffing. I always do the creamed leeks that I started making because there was a recipe in a Paula Wolford book that called for making giant potato pancakes with creamed leeks in the middle. And after I had the potato pancakes fall apart 5 or 6 times, I realized that the part of the dish I actually liked was the creamed leeks.
Now, how do you make creamed leeks?
You know, you wash them, you slice them, you melt them down in kind of more butter than you want to think about. I mean, Thanksgiving is a pound of butter holiday. There's just no way of getting around that. And then you stir in, you know, like a little creme fraiche afterwards, simmer for a couple minutes. It's a delicious dish.
Oh my God, that sounds fantastic.
You can do another good one is Brussels sprouts, where you like grate them instead of cooking them whole, and you cook them hot in butter, and maybe finish that with a little creme fraiche if you want, and then take this like beautiful brown coconutty flavor that's, I think, is amazing, and nobody in my family would touch with a stick.
So are there pre-Thanksgiving items that the kids have to have?
The kids require pies, of course. The kids require cranberry sauce, which I'm ashamed to admit that I still make from Russ Parsons' mother's recipe. It's not a bad one. It's basically the one on the back of the bag with a little bit of orange juice and some mulling spices added. Thanksgiving is the one holiday that's totally the cook's holiday. It's all about the food.
And it should be, rather than being this hysterical, scary, I'm going to screw something up, I'm going to make something somebody doesn't like, the cook should just relax and just be here now. Enjoy that moment in the kitchen.
When else do you get to, like, legally, have your fist elbow deep inside a turkey?
Thank you so much, Jonathan. It's been wonderful talking to you about your pre-Thanksgiving traditions.
Thank you very much.
Jonathan Gold joins us on Good Food every week with a restaurant suggestion. You can find all of his recommendations on the Good Food Restaurant Map. It's on our blog at kcrw.com/goodfood. So far, we've pretty much been focusing on the food, but along with the incredible meal comes lots of family and, let's be honest, some pretty sticky social situations. Helena Eichlin writes the table manners column for Chow.com, and she's here to give us some tips, starting with how to deal with a family member who is always late.
Well, I've actually had some personal experience with this recently, not with a family member, but with a friend who's always at least an hour late. And I've tried all sorts of little ruses with her. I've tried the obvious strategy of telling her a different start time from everyone else. And then she found out that I did that and then started showing up an hour later than whatever time I said, assuming that I was always giving her the wrong start time.
She didn't sort of get the message that you were managing her?
Yeah, that strategy backfired. In fact, I've tried things like sending people to pick her up, and I've come to the conclusion that the best strategy, if you can manage it, and you have to be quite spiritually evolved to do this, is to just accept that they're going to be late. And if you accept that they're going to be late, then I think what happens is you're in a good mood when they show up. And I think the late person can sometimes, if you keep telling them, keep reminding them to be on time and try to make them be on time, then they can feel infantilized and act out and start being even later. So it's very refreshing for them if you just say, this is the time that you have to be there. And then when they show up, just be happy that they're there.
So when we're talking about holiday sit-down meals, like perhaps Thanksgiving or maybe a special Christmas Eve dinner, do we just go ahead and start eating and do we make them a plate and put it aside, or do we just let them join in whenever they come?
You can make them a plate or not, but I think that you should go ahead and start eating because people can have small children or there are old people who need to eat at a reasonable hour. And if everyone's just sitting there getting hungrier and hungrier, then they'll be angry when the person shows up. You should just start eating and then just be happy when the person shows up.
Now let's turn to a problem that may not be with a guest, but maybe with a hostess. What if the hostess has invited everyone for a fabulous Thanksgiving dinner? It's time to sit down and eat and the meal's not ready yet.
I think the first thing to do is be very open with your guests, because people do not like to wait when they don't know how long they're going to be waiting or why they're waiting, especially if they're hungry. So just be very open with your guests and say, look, I'm sorry, the turkey is still frozen, and I think it's going to be ready in like 45 minutes, and then pour another round of drinks.
Thinking about that, pouring another round of drinks, how many rounds do we go before we start to just make spaghetti to tide everybody over?
Well, I think that drunkenness at holiday dinners is a matter of finding the sweet spot, because you don't want people not to be drunk enough, because then things can be tense. But then you don't want people to get too drunk, otherwise things could get ugly.
Have you witnessed that ugliness?
In England, where I come from, obviously, people have a different concept of how drunk is too drunk, because I think we tend to drink a little bit more there. And so I wouldn't say I've witnessed the ugliness. I have witnessed my relatives getting very drunk. I have one relative in particular who I will call Aunt Millicent, and she begins her day with whiskey on her porridge. And on Christmas Day, we have champagne in the morning. So she tends to be pretty sloshed by lunchtime. She makes slightly like ribald remarks to people. So she's definitely acting slightly inappropriate, but it's okay because it's so much better than Aunt Millicent sober. Because when she's sober, she just sits around making passive-aggressive remarks. And if she's drunk, she'll sort of act all jolly, and then after lunch, she'll just fall asleep for a nap. And so it's much better that way.
We've been talking a lot about alcohol, but what if we have people, maybe someone that you know who's recently hit rock bottom and they're in their first days of sobriety? Is it insensitive to drink around them?
Well, I think alcoholics vary. I did a little bit of research on this, and some of them are very uncomfortable around alcohol and some of them are okay with it. So if you know the person well enough, you can just phone them up and ask them, how do you feel about this? And if you don't know them well enough or they say it's okay, I think it definitely is in bad taste to get drunk around a recovering alcoholic. So I think the limit is 3 drinks. And after that, most people start to act a little bit sloppy or obviously drunk. And I always say a good host or hostess should stay on the same chemical wavelength as their guests, roughly. And so, 3 drinks, no more.
Is there a special way of putting together a seating arrangement to ensure that around the table people will enjoy the people next to them or the people that they can actually talk to rather than two people who really like one another shouting down across the table?
First thing I would say is separate couples. Couples should never be allowed to sit together because then they sort of rely on each other and use each other as a crutch. And they should be separated. I like to have people squashed together because I think that creates a sort of more intimate atmosphere. And then the other thing, when you look at sort of old etiquette books on advice about seating arrangements, people often say, oh, put a boring person next to an interesting person. I totally disagree with that. I think you should put all the boring people together.
As like a penalty, they're like in a penalty box.
Something like that.
Well, thank you very much, Helena.
Thanks, Evan.
When John Sedler of the restaurant Rivera stopped by the Good Food Studio earlier this month, I thought he'd be bringing one of his incredible savory side dishes. Instead, he arrived with a bottle and 2 shot glasses.
Well, this is a post-prandial pumpkin mezcal cocktail.
Wow. You know, I really, really love mezcal. How is mezcal different from tequila?
Mezcal is more rustic than tequila. It was always called the poor man's tequila, and it's got a little bit more earthiness to it. It's high in minerals. You can taste a lot of iron. You can taste a lot of copper. And, of course, it has an element smokiness that comes from its production that adds a very comforting, great for the holidays level to it.
Yet it's still made from agave.
It's still made from agave, a kind of maguey. It's not the 100% blue Americana Weber that tequila is made out of.
Now, how do you infuse the flavors of pumpkin into it?
Well, actually, we take golden autumn pumpkins, we caramelize and roast them, and then we make a puree, and we let it sit for about 2 or 3 days till it imparts the creaminess and the caramelization of the pumpkin right into the mezcal.
Wow. And then you strain it, filter it.
Yes.
And you end up with this really beautiful sort of amber liquor.
Yes, it's crystal clear. And if it's a very festive occasion, we'll actually take a little bit of heavy cream and mix in some of the pumpkin puree, sprinkle a little bit of allspice and cinnamon into it, and just top the mezcal with that. It's very, very creamy, and it's kind of like a little milkshake of mezcal.
What a beautiful holiday liquid side dish. Is it complicated for people to make at home?
It's not, and the one thing I recommend is that You just let it steep at least for 3 days. If you have enough time and you do it for 5 to 7 days, it'll be just a little bit more strong in flavor. And depending on what kind of pumpkin you use also, or squash, will make a difference.
And now you're putting a little bit of a creamy business. Is this mascarpone?
No, this is actually heavy cream, and I feel actually the home consumer can buy heavy cream. You know, the if they go to Smart and Final,
they have manufacturing cream.
Yeah, exactly, and so this is a very, very rich. And once it's whipped, it stays whipped. It doesn't
It has
soften.
It has much more body, more butter fat than what we can get in the supermarket. And I'm smelling now the holiday spices.
Good, sweet
spices. So what's in there?
Well, I sprinkle a little bit of cinnamon in there and allspice and a little nutmeg.
Wow, that is so delicious.
If only it would snow here in Los Angeles, they would be the perfect fireside beverage.
Absolutely. But, you know, a lot of times instead of a fire, I think of our sunsets.
Yes.
As like the fireside. So have one of these and gaze out at the sunset. Thank you so much, John.
Thank you, Evan.
The recipe for John Sedler's pumpkin mezcal cocktail is at kcrw.com/goodfood. Randall Rose is the chef at Sublime Food Lounge in Culver City, and I asked him to weigh in with a Brussels sprout suggestion.
We have a charred Brussels sprouts in lardons with the balsamic butter, and we're going to be adding currants and hazelnuts to that for the fall.
So describe how you go about making it, and what do you mean by lardon?
Okay. Lardons can be anything from rendered pork fat all the way to thick-cut bacon, depending on whether you're working in a restaurant or working from home or what you have available. It's any part of the pork that has a higher fat content that you can render out or melt out the fat and use that to saute your vegetables or anything else you'd like to do in that. Traditionally, lardons are pure fat, but again, for the home cook, you can use a thick slab bacon or anything you really salt pork. Anything you want to kind of bring that component to the dish.
And they're cut in a pretty specific way normally.
It's a larger dice. It's more of a chunky. It's not a fine dice or a grind on it at all. It's definitely something a little larger, something that it's a prominent feature of the dish for sure.
So when you go about making these Brussels sprouts, do you first render out the fat and then sort of slather it all over the Brussels sprouts?
Absolutely. The key to this dish is not to kind of boil or steam the Brussels sprouts and there, because that gives you the childhood memory of Brussels sprouts that people aren't fond of. And Brussels sprouts have so much more flavor potential, especially when you start charring or the outside of them, especially in a bacon fat or any kind of fat that you or butter or anything you want to bring to the dish, and really taking the Brussels sprout to a real caramelized and really almost charred exterior to it. And if you take it a little too far, you can always pull some of the exterior leaves off if it's not to taste. But it brings a whole new dimension to a Brussels sprout. And most people that come here that don't like Brussels sprouts, they leave actually having this and thinking it's fantastic. So
yeah, the sweetness of the sprout really comes out.
Absolutely, absolutely. And adding a little bit of currant and hazelnuts and ending with a little splash of balsamic vinegar and a little bit of butter to glaze the Brussels sprouts in also brings out the sweetness and controls that kind of classic bitterness that some people are sensitive to.
Wow, that sounds absolutely delicious. So let us know, since you're pretty new opening, where is the Sublime Food Lounge?
The Sublime Food Lounge is in Culver City, about 2 blocks east of the Helms Bakery area, what is known as the Art District of Culver City, which runs between National and La Cienega on Washington, where you'll find about 30, 35 art galleries within the area. So it's becoming this West Side creative mecca for designers and architects and gallery owners. So it's an up-and-coming area that everyone's really excited about.
Well, it's lovely to meet you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me, and Have a wonderful day and a great holiday season.
Randall Rose's recipe is at kcrw.com/goodfood. I have two favorite ways to make Brussels sprouts. The first requires lots of hands on deck. You unwrap the sprouts into individual tiny leaves. Then you sauté them in olive oil or a lot of butter with good salt and a healthy sprinkling of freshly ground black pepper. If you like bacon, add it to the pan before you toss the leaves in. The other method I like to use is to cut the sprouts in half, toss them with thinly sliced onions, olive oil, salt, and pepper, and roast them in a medium oven until they're caramelized and just tender. If you want, you can drizzle a good quality balsamic vinegar over during the last few minutes of baking. Thanksgiving wouldn't be the incredibly tasty glutton fest that it is without dessert. And for a truly decadent idea, we turn to Valerie Gordon of Valerie Confections. I caught up with her at the Santa Monica Farmers Market.
We are making pumpkin and persimmon bread pudding. It came about as a way to use leftover pumpkin bread. So what I did is I cut up a bunch of leftover pumpkin bread, and since we now use actually freshly baked pumpkin bread because this bread pudding is so luscious, you cut that up, and then I found that the best bread to use for this bread pudding after a few experiments is the buttermilk bread from Trader Joe's. It is a sliced bread. I believe it's $2.69. I've tried really fancy brioche. I've tried challah, all different kinds of bread, and this is the best bread for this bread pudding. The other main ingredient in this bread pudding, of course, is the persimmon. Again, I've tried a couple different kinds of persimmon. I find the Hachia persimmon from J.J. Lone's Daughter is the best persimmon to use. They're incredibly ripe. They're very yielding. So I roast those.
And now, do you just leave them whole? You just put them in a pan, no oil on them, nothing?
Nothing. Stick them on a pan, stick them in the oven. I take the green top off, and that's it.
And these are the really soft kind.
Really soft, very sweet, and they have sort of like this natural hint of vanilla that's really, really delicious. So that goes in the oven. It comes out. I leave half of it chunk, and I puree half of it. And you kind of, you know, you read your pudding. It's like, if you're really into persimmon, stick some more persimmon in there, and you're not going to get in trouble. So that goes into the milk, cream, egg, spice mixture. You mix that all together. And I also add some vanilla paste, which is one of my favorite magic ingredients that just sort of enhances most desserts. That all goes together. You pour it on top of the pumpkin bread and sliced buttermilk bread, and you just let it sit. You mush it down a little bit with a fork until you can tell that it's all sort of come together. It's really, really beautiful. Then I top it with large dollops of caramel and a small sprinkling of fleur de sel.
Just because it's not rich enough.
Just because it's not rich enough. And this thing in the oven, like, totally puffs up in this beautiful, gorgeous way. It comes out. It sinks down. It's incredibly dense, obviously ridiculously rich.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Valerie told me that she gets her pumpkins from Barbara Spencer of Windrose Farms. So while I was at the market, I had to stop by and ask Barbara about this incredible, smallish pumpkin with a rough, textured skin.
These are called Winter Luxury. I don't know where they actually originated from. First of all, feel how heavy it is.
And that's the thing that I always try and tell people when they ask me about buying pumpkin or small squash. Heavy. Why?
More meat. Less air, more meat. But even in small things like delicatas and acorns, even the things that have a hole and a cavity, you still will have that sense of extra weight for the size. Whatever size it is, be it a half pound, 1 pound, 5 pound, you want to feel like, oh, that's heavy for what I'm picking up.
Now, I wanted to ask you about this other squash. These are the same size, smallish, like a...
It's hard to describe.
It's hard to describe because it's not a bowling ball. It's way smaller.
They're called fairy. We grow, basically the only hybrid squashes we grow are the Japanese because they're so good.
So this fairy squash, it's beautiful because it's got green and orange stripes against a creamy white background.
It'll turn more
pumpkin-y,
honey-colored, whatever, as they mature. And again, same thing, even though there is a fairly good-sized seed cavity. They're a pale yellow flesh. They're not a dark flesh,
really?
But it's very smooth. And they're sweet and really good. This is, what I'm holding now is kind of a, not really lemon colored, but yellow colored acorn, as opposed to a green acorn. And again, feel the weight on that thing.
Ooh, I mean, wow, yeah. Nice and heavy.
Yeah. And it's an heirloom called Paydon, P-A-Y-D-O-N, and I get the seed from Seed Savers Exchange, I think is where I get it. And we love this one.
This has been so much fun. Thank you, Barbara.
Our pleasure. Thank you.
Many people have asked me how I like to use winter squash. I've got a couple of really great recipes on the Good Food blog, including one for a butternut squash lasagna. But the easiest last-minute thing to do is to make a Sicilian recipe called zucca in agrodolce, or winter squash marinated in a sweet and sour marinade. All you need in addition to the squash is a little garlic, some mint, red wine vinegar, and sugar. The recipe and a video for how to make it are both on the Good Food blog. A Good Food Thanksgiving continues in 1 minute. Stick around. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be right back.
Hi, this is Cara from Santa Monica. In 1988, my mother and I went with family friends, the Dankers, to Catalina Island for a Thanksgiving we thought would be a lovely picnic, and turned out it was the roughest seas they had had in probably 10 years. Over half of our party got seasick on the way over and ended up not eating much at the dinner. Everyone was a little loopy from the Dramamine patches. But we had a good walk and a brisk picnic and had some good memories and good stories.
Hi, my name is Ellen Margulies, and this is my Thanksgiving story. We were having Thanksgiving dinner at my brother-in-law's home in New Haven, Connecticut. Everyone was sitting around in the kitchen munching on pre-dinner snacks and drinking and talking. When it was time to check and baste the bird again, my sister-in-law was having trouble opening the oven. Everyone tried. The biggest, burliest guest couldn't get it open. It was then discovered that somehow the self-cleaning cycle had been switched on, which meant the oven would be locked for hours. Even shutting it off wouldn't release the lock. Already mourning the lost bird, we started trying to find a pizza place or a Chinese takeout that would deliver. In walks one guest who had an idea no one had thought of. She took a towel, soaked it in cold water, and placed it on the oven door. In no time, we heard a click, and the lock popped open. It was amazing. In her line of work, cold compresses often come in handy. She's a nurse, and she saved our dinner.
This is Shiloh Bisnett. About once a decade, Thanksgiving Day also lands on my birthday, like it did on my 21st birthday. This was also the day that my dad decided to introduce his new girlfriend to me and my brother. I'd started drinking Goldschlager about mid-morning, so by the time dinner came around, I was really, really drunk. In fact, all I remember about that dinner was doing a complete face plant into this ridiculous dish that my dad's girlfriend brought, a completely disgusting cranberry jello salad laced with cream cheese and walnuts. I have never had Goldschlager again, and I was not invited to their wedding.
Roasting the turkey is one of the joys of Thanksgiving. When I was a kid, my mom would stuff the bird and roast it overnight on a very low 250-degree oven. Knowing what we know now, that was more than a little risky. A few people on Facebook have asked about the best ways to roast the turkey, so I wanted to pass on some tips. Every year I roast about 6 to 10 turkeys at the restaurant, and I don't have racks for roasting all those birds.
So what I do is I cut up onions, celery, and carrot into really big chunks. I toss them with some herbs, lemon zest, and a little bit of olive oil, then lay them out into the roasting pan. Then I let the turkeys perch atop the veggies. You end up with really flavorful juices for your gravy that, if you like, you can thicken with a really fine puree of the cooked veg if you want. A listener named Josette asked if it's better to roast the turkey upside down. I have to say that I think this year I'm going to roast my turkeys breast side down. The theory is that all the juices in the bird flow down into the breast meat, keeping it more moist. But I also think that it helps that the breast is more protected that way. And then the meat that takes longer to cook, the legs and the thighs, are up on top. So it really makes a lot of sense. When it comes to turkey, I've wet brined, dry brined, braised, smoked, but something I have never done with the bird is make a turducken. What is that, you ask? Well, C.J. Jacobson, chef at the Yard in Santa Monica, has it on his menu. When I talked to him at the farmer's market, he explained just what a turducken is.
The classic turducken is a deboned chicken stuffed inside of a deboned duck stuffed inside of a deboned turkey. And what we did was exactly that, but we didn't roast the whole thing together. We marinated both the chicken and the duck. We browned off the skin first. We tied it tight with twine, and we used transglutinase, which is kind of like meat glue, to kind of keep it kind of tight in the middle. Then we sous vide it for like 2 hours, 3 hours maybe, like 165, just so that it was already done. And then we made a farce out of chicken thigh meat and foie gras, and we kind of spread that on the inside of the deboned turkey, along with some like sage and herbs and aromatics. And then we kind of cinched that whole thing together. It took me, my sous chef and I, probably about a half hour just to like sew it shut. It was kind of intense. We were both sweating, like with the needle and the thread, like it was very strange actually.
Describe what a farce is.
Farce is essentially a pureed meat. Anything that, you know, you'd want to do like a mousse or something like that could be described as a farce.
Actually, I think sous-viding it is a really smart thing to do, because then it's like perfectly cooked all the way through from center to the outside, which I would imagine when making the classic turducken, there must be parts that are almost raw and parts that are way overcooked.
Yeah, that's what we decided to do it. I mean, we've been talking about this for quite some time, like my chefs and I, and other chefs I talked to as well, and we decided sous vide to be the best way because, you know, we wanted to have that roasty flavor, you know. I didn't want to sous vide the entire thing, plus I don't have a bag big enough, obviously. Sous vide in the inside kept it tight, and we also really wanted to make sure, like, when we sliced it all the way through, there weren't going to be gaps. A lot of people had stuffing to the inside of their turducken. We didn't do that. We wanted the whole thing to be meat, and then we did, like, a side of, like, a bread pudding stuffing.
And how long did it take you to sell it?
Yeah, this is the real bummer of the entire thing. We sold out in one night. And it pretty much took me all week to make, and now it's like really popular, so I don't know what I'm going to do.
Cranberry sauce is a staple of many Thanksgiving tables. I know it's on mine. That tart, tangy, sweet jam goes great with all of those umami flavors in so many traditional Thanksgiving dishes. But if you live in Southern California and you want to eat local, you'll have to find an alternative. I caught up with my friend Delilah Snell at the Santa Monica Farmers Market. She's the owner of The Road Less Traveled, an eco store in Santa Ana. She's also a master preserver. Delilah has some ideas for cranberry sauce alternatives.
The first thing that comes to mind is plums. Plums and pluots both have that tartness and that sweetness that are very reminiscent of cranberries, but also they have that color. Another great thing about plums and pluots is that they have high pectin, so that jelly, gelatinous texture that you get with a cranberry jam is also in any kind of pluot preserve that you make.
Is it hard to preserve them or make a fresh jam? Let's not talk about canning. Just if we want to make something that we're going to refrigerate and then we're going to pull out on Thanksgiving Day and put on the table.
Super easy. You basically grab your plums and wash them. You don't have to peel them. Put them in a pot. For every cup of plums or pluots that you use, you probably want to use about 3/4 cup of sugar. Pour that on top, macerate them, heat them up, cook them for a while. I like to add a little bit of orange juice or lemon juice because that also adds a little bit more of that tanginess that you get from cranberries, and also gives you a different kind of flavor, a little bit more complex flavor. Heat that up for about 30 minutes and get it to a boil, and eventually you'll start to see that kind of jam consistency. Grab a little bit on a spoon, run your finger through it. When it starts to wrinkle, you've got a jam. Put it in the refrigerator. It'll keep for about a month. What about Meyer lemons or mixing a sweet vegetable like an onion with a citrus? One of my new favorite things to make is a play on the marmalade, which is an onion marmalade. And this is something that you can do that's very affordable, very easy to make, and utilizes something that we can get a lot of at all times of the year, which is the onion. What I like to do is take about 4 cups of a mixture of onions, whether that's garlic, shallots, cipollinis, onions. Just go crazy. And the farmer's market is the best place to do that. Even leeks work. Saute them in a pot for about 30 minutes until they get this nice brown color. Then you can take something like oranges, which are abundant everywhere, or lemons or limes, play it up, zest them completely. So maybe about 2 to 3 citrus fruits worth of juice and zest. Then you take some sugar, about a cup, and then 1 cup of cider vinegar. I'm a big fan of cider vinegar. Heat that down, and eventually you'll get that jam consistency again. And again, it'll keep for about a month in the fridge. Really good.
I wanted to ask you, I've been seeing more crab apples this year than I've seen before. These beautiful little apples.
Yes.
Can we do something with those?
A couple things. Crab apples are actually excellent if you want to make your own homemade pectin, which we can talk about at a different time. But crab apples are great for butter. A more tart variation of apple butter, which is very popular this time of year. What you can also do is pickle them. So you get that sweet, tart pickle that looks so beautiful in a jar hole. I would use a quart jar probably for that. You can do something easy by basically taking cider vinegar or white vinegar with water, boiling that and adding a couple cloves, a couple cinnamon sticks, and then pouring that over whole apples, and you're done.
Okay, now we have to talk about the pomegranate. To me, the pomegranate is just the emblematic fruit of Thanksgiving. It's so beautiful, and those little beautiful little arils inside are delicious. What can we do with the pomegranate?
Pomegranate jelly is probably the easiest and tastiest way to enjoy your pomegranates. Juice your pomegranates, which of course is going to be a little messy. I use a regular fruit juicer or vegetable juicer to do my pomegranates, but you can do it the old-fashioned way by hand, which will be a lot of fun. Anyways, you can add your pomegranate juice to a regular non-reactive pot like stainless steel, add some sugar, add a little bit of lemon juice, let that boil, and then add pectin. Eventually, you'll see, again, the jelly consistency on your spoon. And once that happens, you can pour those into decorative jars and keep in the fridge for 1 month. Another thing that I just recently did is infuse vodka with pomegranates. Basically, what I do is take pomegranate seeds or straight pomegranate juice, about 1 cup, and add that to a liter, I think, or 2 of vodka. After about a week, pour in some sugar or some local honey, about maybe 3/4 to a cup. And let that sit for a little while, and in about a month, you'll have a really rich, developed flavor, but you can start using that immediately. I usually can't let it wait that long.
So much fun talking to you. I love getting inspiration. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Evan.
A recipe from Delilah is on our blog at kcrw.com/goodfood. I'll be back after this short break to talk leftovers. You're listening to A Good Food Thanksgiving. Are you wondering why you spend hours creating a Thanksgiving meal? Half the people in your house don't even want to eat? Well, here's an idea. Abandon all those old traditions and make a new one of your own. Carol Murchard and her family did just that. She's here to tell us about their somewhat unconventional Thanksgiving celebration. I understand that you made a video a number of years ago on Thanksgiving that sparked the idea for your new tradition. Could you tell us about that?
We certainly did. Had a video of the kids cooking Thanksgiving dinner. First, we pan to Claire. Claire, what are you making? I'm making stuffing. Will you eat it? No. Go to my daughter, Sarah. Sarah, what are you making? Mashed potatoes? Will you eat it? No. And we realized that we were spending all day cooking foods that my kids didn't even like to eat because we thought it was traditional, because we thought we were supposed to. So I finally decided this is silly. The idea of Thanksgiving is to reflect on things that you're thankful for. And I realized I was not thankful for cooking things that we didn't even want to eat. So we said, let's abandon that, check it out the window. We're going to do it our way.
And what is your way now?
What we do is I have three kids. I ask each one of them, name two foods you're thankful for. Whatever those two foods are, that's what we cook. And if you're thankful for grape soda and Pringles, well, then that's it. Luckily, I'm usually thankful for at least one vegetable. And we have just done this for the past 4 or 5 years, and it's a blast.
Now, aren't you a dietitian?
Yes, I am.
And isn't the whole family vegetarian?
Yes, we are all vegetarians. So part of it is we weren't going to cook a traditional meal anyway. There wasn't going to be the turkey and all that. So once you kind of chuck that out the window, you realize, you know, there's a lot of freedom there.
So tell me if you can remember what the first menu was and then what the menu is you're planning to do this year.
The first menu we had, there was grape soda involved, spinach and pine nuts, two different kinds of pizza, some form of potato chips, and I think a dessert.
And what about the one you're doing now? I'm curious to see how it evolves as the kids get older.
Well, I'll tell you, we haven't even planned one yet because this doesn't take weeks of planning. That's what's good. How it evolves. My son is now into fruits and vegetables now that he's 14. He has decided they're not quite so disgusting. So I bet we could get into that. We're also into different ethnic foods. He is on a samosa kick. So I would not be surprised if this year's what included some type of stir-fried vegetables, some samosas. He's still into that grape soda. And who knows what the girls are going to come up with.
When you do this, do you sit down and pour the grape soda into wine glasses and have the Pringles
Absolutely.
In a beautiful bowl?
Yes, yes. We do it up that way. There's candles on the table and some flowers, maybe some pumpkins that we've decorated. You know, it is very festive and very fun. And afterward, we usually sit and watch a movie. And at the beginning of the dinner, everyone goes around the table and says what they're thankful for.
Whose idea was it? Was it yours or the kids?
I think it was mine. I think I was just so tired of spending Thanksgiving cooking food they didn't want to eat and then the rest of the day doing the dishes.
So how has the change impacted your enjoyment of the holiday?
It's great. It's wonderful. I am not sitting there the day before Thanksgiving at the grocery store with 700 other harried people. I'm not cooking and baking endlessly. It's very chill. I don't know if you've ever seen Jim Gaffigan as a comedian. He does this great routine about Thanksgiving, and he talks about how it's a whole day where you just eat way too much and you stuff yourself. And his response is, but we do that every day. And I think, you know, that's what I don't want this holiday to be. I don't want it to be just about overeating. I want it to be something where the focus is, what are you thankful for?
Do you ever invite outsiders to your Thanksgiving?
We have every once in a while. We try to honor their traditions. But it is difficult with the kids and the vegetarianism sometimes. But I have found their friends all want to come.
I'm sure.
Because it's so relaxed. I mean, think of all the holidays you remember growing up, and even, you know, as an adult with your kids, where it was stressful. You spent the day cooking and worrying and timing and get out of the kitchen. And, you know, that's not what it's about. It's about being thankful and enjoying your friends and your family. And sometimes letting things go. So I suggest to people, I mean, you don't have to go as far as we did. But look at that whole menu and ask yourself, would anybody really miss that if it was gone? And then just leave those few things that are those key favorites for people.
Did anybody ever find their way to your house and not be prepared?
I think if you're coming to my house, you better be prepared.
I'm just imagining a reaction of someone. Carol, it's been a pleasure. A breath of fresh air.
Well, good. I hope everyone has a great Thanksgiving.
Thanksgiving? Yeah. Thanksgiving. It's like we didn't even try to come up with a tradition. The tradition is we overeat.
Hey, how about Thanksgiving we just eat a lot?
We do that every day.
Oh, what if we eat a lot with people that annoy the hell out of us?
Oh, he's the anti-family.
You know what I'm thankful for? Leftovers. My favorite post-Thanksgiving meal is actually the full Thanksgiving plate, without any of the pressures of having to make the meal or entertain. Tucking into that plate the next day is heaven. I asked some of the many chefs we talked to today to tell us what they like to do with Thanksgiving leftovers. Here's what they had to say.
After Thanksgiving, our family tradition is really, actually not my family tradition, my mother's family tradition, because I don't know how to make it, is this traditional Cantonese dish called juk, which is like a rice porridge, very country. My mom takes all the leftover bones and turkey scraps and makes this rice porridge with it that's absolutely fantastic. I think of it as the day after Thanksgiving food, the way people think of turkey and stuffing sandwiches. I think of turkey juk.
My favorite thing to eat, which I only eat usually this time of the year, is turkey pot pie. I love turkey pot pie. And, you know, all the beautiful vegetables that you can get here, the Weiser potatoes, the McGrath carrots, you know, some onions, with that rich gravy left over from Thanksgiving. Delicious.
Since I cook Thanksgiving all day long for days, and we do it in the restaurant, you never really enjoy the food that much that day. So I just like to eat the leftovers. My ritual is a piece of pumpkin pie for breakfast on Friday. Have to have that. And then I usually go with the turkey sandwich for lunch. And I usually have, you know, the whole meal for dinner. By Saturday, I'm a little burnt out. Once in a while, I can have a little more, but then I'm done. Then I need Asian food.
Actually, at our restaurant, we have a turkey bolognese. And what we do is we will braise the thighs. So if you got some leftover thighs or legs, you can just shred that meat, make a little stock, reduce it down, make a sofrito, some marinara, and booyah, you got bolognese.
I eat them pretty much exactly as they are the next day. It's almost like I want to relive the experience over and over as many times as I can. When I'm eating leftover Thanksgiving dinner, I compose the plate almost exactly how I enjoyed it the night before. And I like to have as many of the components as I possibly can. And I stick it in the oven and I sit there and it's just, I almost prefer it. The next day, I have to say, I almost prefer it.
That was Sasha Alger, Joseph Gillard, Akasha Richman, CJ Jacobson, and Valerie Gordon. I want to thank everyone who participated in today's show. You can find lots of recipes, photos, and videos on the Good Food blog. Find it all at kcrw.com/goodfood. You can hear Good Food every Saturday at 11 a.m. here on KCRW. A Good Food Thanksgiving was produced and edited by Harriet Ells with Jillian Ferguson, Laurel Garcia, Connie Alvarez, Candace Moyer, and Bob Carlson. Thanks to Gary Messiha, Ronnie Mickelson, and Becky Nelson. I'm Evan Kleiman. Have a wonderful Thanksgiving.